some music and a video to take us into our message today.
Rejected by others.
I know, but not by the Messiah. God is spirit, and the time is coming and is now here that it won't matter where you worship, but only that you do it in spirit and truth. Heart and mind, that is the kind of worshiper he's looking for. It won't matter where you're from or what you've done. Do you believe what I'm telling you?
Until the Messiah comes and explains everything and sorts this mess out, including me, I don't trust in anyone.
You're wrong when you say that you've never received anything from God. This Messiah you speak of, I am he. The first one was named Ramin. You were a woman of purity who was excited to be married. But he wasn't a good man. He hurt you, and it made you question marriage and even the practice of your faith.
Stop it.
The second was Farzad. On your wedding night, his skin smelled like oranges. And to this day, every time you pass by the oranges in the market, you feel guilty for leaving him, because he was the only truly godly man you've been with. But you felt unworthy.
Why are you doing this?
I have not revealed myself to the public as the Messiah. You are the first. It would be good if you believed me.
You picked the wrong person.
I came to Samaria just to meet you. Do you think it's an accident that I'm here in the middle of the day?
I am rejected by others.
I know. But not by the Messiah.
And you know these things because you are the Christ. I'm going to tell everyone.
I was counting on it.
Spirit and truth.
Spirit and truth.
It won't be all about mountains or temples.
Soon, just the heart.
You promise?
I promise.
This man told me everything I've done. Oh, he must be the Christ!
Hey, wait!
Your water!
You forgot your
Fancy, a man who told me everything I ever did!
Rabbi, we got food. What would you like?
I have food to eat that you do not know about.
Who got you food?
Roses are red. Grass is green. You think that you're handsome, but it's only a dream. What I just shared with you was written to me by my mother in my autograph book when I graduated from eighth grade. Yeah, Mom was always that pillar of support. But it's very much on topic with our talk today, as you'll find out in just a bit. This past week, I was trying to figure out exactly what message I wanted to share with you this morning. I ended up going down a very different path than I had intended, because at first, I thought I would talk about the difference between our human lives and our spiritual lives. Then I realized that I couldn't do that because a very significant part of my own personal beliefs is that to me, our human lives and our spiritual lives are one and the same. Were we able truly to separate who we are from what we are, there no longer would be a what we are. There is this inseparable bond between our souls and every single breath that we take. There's this inseparable bond between our spiritual self and our world. How we show up every day, how we manifest ourselves every day, how we experience absolutely everything that happens to us in every moment is directly related to how we finish the sentence, "I am." There's a recent saying that has become popular, and I notice it's become particularly popular in Unity. It says, "We are spiritual beings having a human experience." But to me, this is a distinction without a difference, because we definitely are human beings here to have a spiritual experience, are we not? And I believe our call is not to shed our humanity or to transcend it, but rather to elevate it, to make it all that it could be. Because if we were here to overcome our humanity, then traditional Christmas dogma must have had it right the whole time. We must, after all, be sinners, and we are not worthy. Anyway, if you've been paying attention, I just spent like, I don't know, 3 minutes talking about a path that I wouldn't go down and talking about the concept of you only live twice. So let me shift gears here a bit by asking you a question. What do you want to be when you grow up? And no, I'm not kidding. Take just a couple of seconds. Put some thought into it. What do you want to be when you grow up? If you possibly could shed, even for a moment, what it is that you do and who you are, what is it? What would you like to put in its place? And don't go to that place of, I can't even deal with a question like that. I got kids to deal with. I got a husband or a wife to deal with. Or I can't go there because the truth is, all I can do is contend with this job that consumes me. Or maybe you're reacting by thinking something like, you know what? You absolutely got to be kidding me. I mean, what is the point of it at my age of thinking what I want to do with the rest of my life? When you're 80 or 70 or 60 or 50 or even 40 years old, that question just doesn't make any sense. You do what you have to do. You are who you are. But I'm telling you that the question does make sense, regardless of whether you are 80 or 8. If you're not asking that question of what will I be when I grow up, then you never will grow. You will just grow old. And by the way, that can become your fate just as much at the age of 20 or 30 as it can at the age of 80 or 90. Back when I was in the third grade, we were given a project. We had to put together not just a paper, but really a difficult task at that age. We were put together a detailed folder answering the question, what I want to be when I grow up. And we were supposed to provide not just reasons, but to dress it up and provide illustrations, all kinds of things to show we really had put some thought into it. I still remember it. I put this masterpiece together and asserted that I wanted to become a priest. I decorated the cover. I could still see it, an orange cover. It had to be orange. And I decorated it with magazine pictures of priest vestments and all sorts of religious symbols. And with colored pencils, I wrote all kinds of captions, highlighting how wonderful it would be to become a priest. I'm telling you, I poured my heart into that project. Of course, a few years later, I discovered the wonder and beauty of girls, and that affirmation that I had been holding of I am going to be a priest became I am going to become a priest, not. But the interesting part about it is, I never lost the aspiration to be in the ministry. Celibacy certainly was a big comeback, but there were others that were even bigger. Short of the priesthood, Catholicism absolutely put a lid on how much you could minister to others. And for women, it was even more restrictive. When I discovered unity, a significant part of the message that I heard was, maybe I could dust off that lifelong dream that I had put into storage so many years earlier. Today, I'm thrilled to be living the life of a minister, but yet I must share with you, I'm not quite there yet. I am still pursuing it, and I have come to appreciate that I always will be. Just as a doctor is said to be practicing medicine, if and when I stop trying to become a minister, then it would mean that I have just stopped ministering. Everything just shriveled up and a dream has gone away. The song that I played before the talk is the theme song from the movie You Only Live Twice. And the lyrics of the song make a distinction. We all have two lives. There's the life you live, your life, and the life you dream. And generally, they don't mix well. There is the dashing James Bond, 007, living a life of adventure, a life of excitement, a life of travel, a life of accomplishment, a real sense of purpose. But then there's his second life, a life of his dreams, a dream that centers on love, on being loved and loving. Interestingly enough, the more recent James Bond movies deal a lot more with the unfulfilled James Bond, a 007 who, in different words, asks the question, what will I be when I grow up? Dreams play a significant role in the scriptures. In almost every passage in which they occur, they serve to spell out or clarify what the life of the character having the dream is all about and what they are called to do. In effect, they introduce challenges and possibilities that open a door between what has been and what could be. And in the book of Genesis, the character of Joseph gets himself into trouble by sharing with his 11 brothers his dream of them bowing down to him. Well, that probably was not very bright on Joseph's part, because Joseph already was the favorite child of Jacob, and already his brothers were jealous of him, so much so that they plotted to kill him. The metaphysics for us in the story is how we go about the business of trying to kill off that part of ourselves that dreams, especially that part of ourselves that dreams beyond the borders that the world has constructed and built around us. In the story, instead of killing Joseph, they sell him off to Potiphar, a high-ranking official to the Pharaoh in Egypt. And Joseph ends up becoming a real honcho in Egypt because of his ability to interpret dreams. He is appointed governor and is put in charge of distributing food during a time of famine. And the reason that this is important is that it shows a practical connection between what we dream and what we experience in our everyday lives. The life that we do not live, the life that our dreams constantly call us to, isn't about a life of frivolous fantasy. It's about a life of ever-growing fulfillment. Even though Joseph ended up being a big man in town, his journey wasn't easy, because along the way, Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. He rejects her. And in turn, in spite, she accuses Joseph of trying to make unwanted advances toward her. And he ends up getting thrown into prison. The scripture easily could have been written without this part being included. But it tells us something. It reminds us. It reminds us of setbacks that we realize when we reach for the stars, that these setbacks happen to us all of the time. And it's only when we use those setbacks as opportunities that our dreams begin to merge with our everyday lives. The video that I played before, the one that I played before the talk, was a liberal interpretation of the gospel story about Jesus meeting the woman at the well. In the story, Jesus is inviting the woman to consider possibilities. And she responds by resisting. There's simply no room for those possibilities given what her life has been and what it is at that moment. And so she pushes back at what Jesus is offering to her. However, she leaves the door open just a wee bit, saying that maybe when the Messiah comes along, then maybe, just maybe, change in the types of things Jesus was talking about could become real. The woman at the well had a lot of reasons to be skeptical. She was a Samaritan, people who were regarded as inferior by the Jews, people that were looked down upon by the Jews. Secondly, she had had 5 husbands, which was 4 above the legal limit that the culture of that time allowed. Also, she was now with a man who was not her husband. But Jesus spoke to her of possibilities. And the words came out of Jesus' mouth, but they were the words of the Christ. What was didn't matter. Her circumstances were of no consequence. Now, going forward, it was only about spirit and truth. Worshiping God was not about temples and mountains. Going forward, it would all take place in the heart. It was a promise. It was a promise that was kept and is still kept until today. And yet it's a promise that the world still refuses to trust in so many ways. I don't know if any of you out there are Trekkies, but I recall an old Star Trek episode in which the Starship Enterprise was in real serious trouble. And the only far-reaching chance they had of surviving was to fuel the engines by mixing matter with antimatter. But according to the laws of physics, when matter and antimatter are mixed, the result is an explosion destroying them and everything that is around them. All that's left is a real explosive energy. Well, needless to say, this is their only chance for survival, so they give it a shot. And of course, it works. If the lives we live are matter, dreams may in fact be antimatter. Mixing them can be risky. Incorporating your dreams into the storms of life can be incredibly devastating. In fact, the world warns us in so many ways about the dangers of following and pursuing our dreams. We're told, don't take chances. You can get hurt doing something like that. Get real. That's not what life is all about. Play it safe. You understand that you could lose everything here. In the ancient world, marriages were prearranged for a reason. It was safe. We had to protect the culture, the society, from being infiltrated by strangers. And so marriage counselors set the whole thing up, and the message was, we will decide for you what's a good fit. And if you don't love the other person, you will either learn to love him or her, or you'll just have to live with the situation. I remember my father had one really simple dream in life. He wanted to open a very small hot dog stand. And there was nobody, including me, who supported him. We all lined up, beginning with my mother and continuing on through with me and all of my siblings, telling him of the risks involved, sometimes screaming at him that this just was not something that was realistic. And looking back, I believe that the real truth at that time was our real concerns weren't so much about the risks involved for Dad, but rather for us. To support his dream would have meant being involved on our part, being there for him, giving him time and energy, and possibly investing money and taking a financial risk on our part. And so that brings us to another significant aspect about following our dreams. Very often when the naysayers are trying to discourage us, they're not expressing concern that we are going to fail, but rather that we might succeed and they will be left behind. Did you ever consider that maybe one of the underlying causes of racism is a deep down knowing, a deep down understanding that people of color inherently really are equal and are not inferior? With her permission, I share with you today that Susan will be retired as of Friday of this week. Yay! Retirement is the permanent withdrawal from your job. It should be a joyful time, and yes, we are going to celebrate it. It should be a time in which you can sit back, relax, breathe deeply, and just enjoy life. And I want Susan to do that for as long as she may want. It also should be a time of restoration and healing. But I think retirement is an ill-chosen word. I think we should call it reimagination, because at some point, it should be a time once again to review and renew the question, what do I want to be when I grow up? And I may be asking that question at the age of 65 or 70, but it's no less significant than asking it at the age of 10 or 18 or 21. Because at any age, the question should be shrouded in the same youthful enthusiasm and sense of wonder. And yes, a tiny element of fear for seasoning really is an okay and healthy thing. Well, you may ask the question, if what I'm suggesting defies the whole notion of living in the moment. And I would answer by saying that being in the moment really is all about becoming in the moment. And when you are living your dream, you are fully engaged in the process of making your dream come true one moment at a time. And it's a process that has no end. It's not about buying a lottery ticket and parking yourself on the couch and watching the lottery drawing with your fingers crossed. In the actual novel, You Only Live Twice, which inspired the movie, the author Ian Fleming shares a haiku poem. You only live twice, once when you are born and once when you look death in the face. The judgment you experience at that moment will come from within and nowhere else. And the question that will be put to you won't be, did you have dreams? The question will be, what did you do about them? And so now, we're going to go back to screen sharing and take this to prayer and meditation.